Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we go into the Wayback Machine, talking about some past incredible trips that we've done, and we kind of reflect on the past.
Oh, yeah. Time to pull out stuff from the drawer, you know, airlines that don't even exist anymore, right?
Yeah, and the fun thing that sort of, you know, struck this topic for us, though, is this whole talk of United trying to buy American or merge with American and then United trying to buy JetBlue. I think there's just a lot of talk about, you know, United, and it sparked a lot of memories, I think, for both you and I.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have some very fond memories of a former airline that became part of United, right? So, and I guess their logo continues to live on.
Yeah, I had some fond memories of that one too. So why don't we dive into it?
Sure.
What we're talking about, folks, is a small little airline that used to be based out of Houston, Texas, called Continental.
You know, my dad still, you know, whenever he sees a United plane, he always calls it Continental. So.
Oh, really?
Because you know he recognizes the lovely blue globe right on the tail.
Yeah. Well, and the fun part of this is. You know, Gordon Bethune, who was the CEO of Continental, you know, many, many years ago, probably decades at this point, we actually had referenced Gordon Bethune on a prior episode when we had Michael Rubiano on talking about the Star Megadues. Mm-hmm. Because Bethune really embraced the community, the flyer talkers and such. And so Continental really has a steeped history in our community, I think. And it's a shame that they've kind of gone by the wayside, and not a lot of its vestiges remain. We'll get to probably a little later after you share a story, and I'll share a little bit of a story myself about where they still sort of remain. But really, I have a lot of fond memories of Continental. It's just a different kind of airline compared to the environment of all the airlines that we have now.
Absolutely. I mean, you bring up Gordon Bethune, you know, legendary CEO.
Absolutely legendary.
Worked at Boeing, I believe. So, you know, had kind of a little bit of an engineering background as well. And at the same time, had a real philosophy on how he ran Continental for a number of years. Now, mind you, he wasn't, I think, the CEO when they merged with United. I think there was a different CEO at that time. But he was a pretty significant and I would say a consequential executive for Continental, really in kind of the first half of the decade of the 2000s, because I feel like that's when he had probably his most influence in on the carrier.
Yeah, I mean, I would put Gordon Bethune up there with Crandall, with Kelleher, with oh gosh, what was his name? Trip.
Juan Trip.
Way back, yeah, Juan Trip.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's pretty high up there. I would definitely put him as definitely one of the more consequential CEOs and executives in the air, you know, aerospace, you know, arena, especially in the, you know, early part of the 21st century. So, which is incidentally the time period frame where I happen to be referencing, because you know we were having this conversation where I think we were talking about airline mergers and stuff, and of course you know that we talked a little bit about Gordon Bethune. And we, you know, part of it also came up in the episode we recorded just a little while ago with Ed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ed.
Because, you know, one of the things we just talked about was just how some of the catering on some of the big three airlines, you know, and, you know, especially I think, unfortunately, especially on United and American, I think, has kind of suffered. And that's very antithetical, I think, to kind of what Gordon Bethune evangelized while he ran the airline. You know, I remember his quote that I keep like quoting is, you know, you can make a pizza so cheap that nobody will want to eat it.
I think we see that, unfortunately, far too many times now, really. And it's true, though. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because Continental, my first experience with Continental, I was a long-term United guy. I was mm-hmm. like, I would go out of my way to get on that United 757 anytime I could. And that seat, 7D, I think it was my seat. if I didn't get the upgrade to the front cabin as a 1K or an expat or a Plat Pro or whatever the one level below that was, I was sitting in 7D. And I remember flying out of Tucson. I'd been at a conference for work and had to fly just a quick hop Tucson to Houston and then get back to the East Coast. And I'm on this small little jet, just in economy, and they give me a muffin. And I'm a United guy at this point. United got no muffins. There were no muffins on United. And so I'm looking at this and I'm like, wow, this is delightful. I didn't expect this. This is maybe I need to make my way onto Continental more often. And then I had that connection in Houston, and I get on a nice aircraft with a screen.
Mm-hmm.
They had the screen, and if I recall, they had like DirecTV or something like that. Like, you could actually watch something of meaning, and so suddenly this United diehard is like, hey, Continental's not so bad.
Yeah, I think they understood some things. You know, some of these amenities, some of these creature comforts are very memorable. You know, and I remember Gordon Bethune getting on, you know, on that TV screen on a Continental plane and explaining, you know, to the audience, you know, after, you know, other things, you know, thanking you for your business and all that. But he made a point to point out, you know, Continental's about offering meals at mealtime and, you know, offering entertainment. And he saw that, I think, as a differentiator. And Continental, you know, was definitely an airline that I seeked out. You know, I felt like if I was going to be on a Continental flight, it would probably be superior to quite a few other flights that I would have taken. You know, going back in that history museum, the Wayback Machine, should I say, back in the early 2000s, there was actually a bit of an alliance, which was kind of unique. It wasn't SkyTeam, it wasn't Star Alliance, it wasn't Oneworld. It was this weird alliance where Northwest and Continental were big code share partners. And one of the things that I remember is, you know, I actually did fly a lot of Northwest, but I actually enjoyed flying Continental quite a bit more and just, you know, having my miles credit to my Northwest account where I would have my elite status. Just because, you know, again, just for those creature comforts, because if you fly on a Northwest plane, you were not getting a screen. You may not be getting a meal, but you were more likely to have that, especially if you're sitting in the back on a Continental flight.
Yeah, and Continental, if I recall, they took good care of you in other ways, right? Didn't you have a operational upgrade at one point that you were reflecting on?
Yeah, so let's get into it. So I think one of the things that, you know, again, this is travel stories, so I thought it make some sense to talk about a travel story, and this one would be from quite a while back, you know. So this is a flight that I took. I think this was my first flight to Hawaii, actually, ever, and I managed to grab a sub. I think it was probably like a $300-something flight from DC connecting in Houston to Honolulu, and of course in economy. And I was a newly minted Northwest elite at this time. So this probably would have been like late 2001, early 2002, somewhere in that range. Had the opportunity to fly this. I was going with my sister and her boyfriend at the time. So there was three of us traveling. And, you know, I really hadn't expected a lot. It was actually also one of the first times I think I flew through or transited through Houston as well. So this was a lot of new things. And, again, this relatively inexpensive economy ticket. I get to Houston, you know, I sit around at the gate, and I forget if I actually knew that I was not entitled to an upgrade or not. But of course, I was wondering. You know, I was newly minted elite, and hey, you know, it had been working out so far. Even as like a silver, which is what I was, I was still getting upgraded occasionally, and I was pretty happy about that. And lo and behold, they oversold coach, and they upgraded me. And this turned out to be really an epic trip and an epic flight, and one that I remember tremendously, you know, even 20 years later or more than 20 years later now.
Anything more you want to share on this, on what made it as epic as it was?
Well, number one, it was, you know, it was intercontinental, right? So it was from Houston to Honolulu. It was a pretty long flight.
So that's a wide body or a narrow body?
And it was on a wide body. Yeah, it was on a 767, a Continental 767. And at the time for that route, their business class product was called Business First, right? Because, you know, they were one of these newer American carriers that didn't have a first class. They had just business class, right? And that was they just have the two cabins, business class and economy. And that's how they branded it. The Continental front cabin was called Business First. And this was an interesting layout because this is on the 767. These were these old recliner seats, which actually reclined quite a bit. And what's even more interesting is on a 767, it was 212, which is kind of a weird layout. And I was in the aisle of the one. I was in the, I guess, all the throne seats. But that was just interesting. It was a super comfortable flight. Everything about it was really great. Of course, it was catered really well. I have some photos. I'm going to probably try to throw this up on the YouTube version of this podcast so that people can see some of this. In fact, I still have, and maybe you guys can see this, I still have my Continental amenity kit. Oh, I have it upside down. Let me see. Yep. This is the Continental amenity kit from that. There's nothing in it. So
just a little bit worn.
A little bit worn. You could barely make out the Continental globe. Fortunately, no 25-year-old lotion or toothpaste in there. And guess what I have? I managed to go through all my airline menus, and I, of course, have the Business First menu that I have. And I can actually go over kind of the meal that I had on that trip, which was pretty amazing. It started out with a salmon appetizer, sterling silver steak, ice cream. That was actually the return. By the way, I got operationally upgraded both directions. So that's even crazier. This is actually, I think, the one that I have pictures of.
I tell you, talk about going in the Wayback Machine. You're even pulling out the menu.
I'm pulling out the menu. You see the beautiful little hibiscus on the front? It says Business First, you know, up here. And, you know, I had Bluebell homemade ice cream. It was a wonderful sundae. I think it might have been the first sundae that I had on a plane. It was quite memorable. Again, I remember getting this upgrade, getting on, and just being like just the sea of relaxation of, number one, having like absolutely no one next to me, just like two aisles, you know, on either side of me. And then of course, I'm given a present, you know, I'm given an amenity kit, like, I get a present? Like, what is this thing? Because, you know, obviously up to then, I'd only been upgraded on domestic flights. This is my first time being upgraded on kind of a transcontinental type of flight, on continental.
Had you flown transcontinental in a premium cabin before this point, or was this your
first? I had as a kid, and it was interesting. I think it was just because we were unaccompanied minors. They put us up in the upper deck of a 747-200 on Northwest Airlines when we flew over to Korea once. And I didn't know what the heck was going on. I just remember sitting in coach and some flight attendant coming and be like, "Okay, kids, get up. We're moving to better seats." I'm like, "What? Are you sure?" You know, I remember being like 9 or 10 and like being very skeptical about this strange woman telling me to move my seat.
As you're getting moved into like the cargo hold.
Yeah. I was like, where were they taking us? And then we went upstairs and we went upstairs to business class. And I remember being served some melon with ham and thinking, who eats melon with ham? You know, and thinking they have weird food here is what I remember. As a child. But we're going off really off tangent here, by the way.
It wouldn't be travel stories without a tangent.
I guess it wouldn't. But I do remember us getting up from coach, seeing some like military uniformed individuals taking our seats, and then us going up to the upper deck and thinking, wow, this is a lot nicer up here. It's quite a bit more spacious.
So let's bring it back to the 767. So here you are. Mm-hmm. You're a 212 configuration. You've enjoyed your Bluebell ice cream. You've had your shrimp or salmon. You've had your sterling silver steak.
Yes, I have.
And you're just enjoying yourself. This is a Barca lounger type style seat, I imagine. It is a little footrest, maybe.
Definitely not lie flat. This is pre lie flat. But it was a Barca lounger with a lot of recline. And again, I'll throw up some photos of what the seat looked like. But again, dining well. You know, I finished my meal. I'm relaxing. I'm watching a movie. you know, on my little personal screen that folds out. And I realized, hey, I wanted my headphones, which I left with my sister. So I go back to the cheap seats, go visit her.
You went to the unwashed.
I did the unwashed masses. I went to go grab my headphones because I wanted to listen to my MP3 player. I don't know. It probably wasn't a Zune. It might have been like a Rio MP3 player or something. This will date this. The time of this flight.
Maybe an Arcos.
So I go back there and then, you know, grab my headphones. Say, hey, can I get my headphones back? I want to use them. And like, okay. So then I start heading back and she's like, hey, so how is it up there? And I pause for a second. And I think, wait, I could lie to her, but I don't. I just say, I could lie to you, but it's fantastic.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's just wonderful. You can't beat that.
No. But anyway, yeah, it was an amazing flight. Again, memorable meal service. Still have photos of it. Still remember it. And I think, you know, clearly by the, you know, the printed menu and everything, you know, this was, I think, a very good showing for Continental. I mean, they were clearly investing in the product. They had a celebrity chef on the other way back. And yeah, as I just mentioned, I was also operationally upgraded on the way back, which is, how do you do that? You know, how do you get two operational upgrades both ways to intercontinentally? By the way, I have another story about that we might have to talk about later, but...
a little teaser for
what's to come, but this was definitely the first time I've had it happen, and it was very memorable. Again, I still have some of the little mementos and souvenirs from that trip, and you know, it's back when they did it right. I would imagine if I were flying Houston to Honolulu, I'm guessing they still have that route or something on United. I would probably guess that my meal would not be as good as what I was served back then.
Oh, of course not. I mean, you know, things have changed. Obviously, you know, you might have quinoa. Quinoa.
You really love to bring up quinoa.
I have the worst. I'm very bad with that, but I just can't stand it. Like, I can't understand why that is on an aircraft. I don't even seek it out on the ground. Why would I seek it out in the air? Like, if you want to give me rice, potatoes, those are fine.
Well, they don't have to heat it up, I guess. You know, it's something they can serve chilled.
Is that what they can do?
Maybe that's why. Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of going back there. Yeah, Gordon Bethune didn't see Continental's merger with United. That was Jeff Smyzik, who, interestingly enough, took over the larger United airline from, I think it was Glenn Tillerson. Was it? Glenn Tilton, who was the United CEO at the time. It's interesting when you think about it, because the same thing happened with American and US Airways, right? The US Airways crowd under Parker took over American rather than you know the American CEO. It's sort of like the small guy.
I think Smyzik came from Continental, or did he come from?
Yeah, Smyzik came from Continental.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he took over from Bethune in 2002.
Okay.
So my memory of Continental, other than the muffin, was on a 2011 or 2012 flight back during the merger. And I was very much a United loyalist. And so I was always focused on flying United Metal, even though they had the what we call the dorm room seating, right? Like on a 777, it was like the 242, you know, kind of lay flat business class. And I had just been generally just focused on that because I thought it was a pretty decent seat. We're in Rio de Janeiro on a very complex itinerary, which I think I've shared on prior episodes. So I'll just talk about the little bit of the Continental tie-in. And one flight gets canceled or delayed 12 hours. I convince United to instead fly me out of Rio instead of Buenos Aires, where I was supposed to fly out of.
Mm-hmm.
And because they changed the flight, it turned into a Y fare. And so I convinced them to apply a system-wide. And so now I'm going from an economy trip out of Buenos Aires, via, I think it was Houston to Baltimore. Now I'm Rio to Sao Paulo to Newark to Baltimore. And originally I was trying, originally they put us to Dulles, but the Dulles leg got canceled somehow. And so by the time that we end up getting into Sao Paulo and getting on our plane into Newark, it's a 767. We're in that BE Aerospace. I think it's now Collins sort of lay flat seat that, you know, you kind of do the footsie with your seatmate because there's
it's a 2-2, right? So small. Where they're on you've got a partner. You're paired up. Yeah.
Yep. 2-2. And so we sit down, and at this point we were all exhausted. My wife and I had started our day at like probably 8 or 9 to get to the airport. We had gone through, we had left the country in Rio. We had negotiated our way back into the country in Rio so we could go and check in for our flight, for our new United flights. Then we had to leave the country again. We had to fly, even though we're quote unquote out of the country, we were flying from Rio out of the international terminal to Sao Paulo into the international terminal. We end up going into the United lounge, which was probably the worst lounge I have ever seen. This is back when the Sao Paulo terminal, the international terminal, which I think you saw a little piece of, like the like I think I had described or shown you a part, because I think it's now like the domestic terminal. The new international is great. It's just gorgeous,
right?
But the old one felt like my 10th grade biology lab.
You were telling some horror stories about the terminal, and then we went there, and then I was like, huh, it's not so bad here. What are you talking about?
They have done a lot. I mean, but like the sights and smells and all that other fun stuff. And we ducked into the United Club very, very briefly. And they didn't even have a single clean glass. You know, like the wine is sitting out warm. There's no ice. There's no other beverages. There's not even a single clean glass. There's not even an empty seat. Many of the seats are looking very torn or very tired. It was like, I'm like, this is not the experience we were looking for here.
Yep.
And we get on board, and I'm at this point I'm punchy, and so my wife and I sit down, and the flight attendant comes by, and you know, it's the tight seat, you're fairly tight with each other, and he welcomes us on, and I say, and you know, we're polite, and then I say, and you can just put the chiller right between our our seats, that'd be wonderful, with a nice bottle of champagne, and we'll both have the Chateaubriand, please. he had a good laugh, and we all had a good laugh, and he was a good sport. The irony, going on tangents, is that Americans started serving Chateaubriand like only like 5 years later on their South American flights.
Wow.
Yeah, I was rather surprised. They did that for a while around the Olympics, going back and forth to Santiago and Rio as one does.
And you know, the pre U.S. Airways management, right? American had really good catering. You know, in fact, you know, when I stopped flying Delta as much as I did, and kind of moved my allegiance over to American for a while there, you know, I just remember, you know, kind of being a little bit shocked, because I'm like, wait, warm nuts? You serve those? And then being served a sundae, you know, on a meal, you know, from Dulles to Dallas, you know, which is, you know, only a 2.5-3 hour flight, but being served ice cream sundae, I was quite shocked. I was like, "What? You're actually serving an actual meal and having courses, and you know, actually having like a you know, ice cream with toppings? Like that's crazy."
It was the cookie for me.
Ah,
I think it was not just American; it was United too had the cookies. There was a period of time in like that 2008, 2009 to like 2000 maybe 14 or so, maybe 15.
Yes.
Where the cookie was king, and everybody was so focused on the cookie. I remember right around the time where they started tweaking the recipe, and Gary had a couple of posts on it, Gary Leff, on View from the Wing, and my gosh, the amount of people that were up in arms that they were changing the cookie.
Yes.
That, well, I mean, that was the thing. That was the thing. You you'd finish your meal. As you're finishing your meal, they'd put it into the oven, and the smell, the fragrance of the cookie would waft into the cabin. And you're just like, oh, this is like, you know, I'm not going to say it's like, you know, grandma's house, but I mean, it's a dang good cookie. And
I like the cookie.
It puts you in the right frame of mind for just, you know, having a nice rest of your flight. You know, you break a little piece out. Maybe you put it in milk. Maybe you just enjoy it, you know, without the milk. And I mean, these were like the cookies that nowadays I think stores charge like $3, $3 to $5 for.
Yeah, you'd probably pay that just for the butter. I do love the cookies, but you know, I miss the sundaes too. So I think they moved from the sundaes to the cookies, and I miss my ice cream.
Yeah, I mean, they need to bring dessert back. The dessert. I mean, the thing is it just kind of comes down to how, you know, what their priorities are, right? I think there was an article a couple of probably like a month or so ago that Kirby says, Scott Kirby, the CEO of United, said that he doesn't eat on a transatlantic red eye.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when we see the quality of the food,
we
can tell you don't eat it because if you you know, you're not putting any money into it.
Yep.
But on the main show, Sam and Robert were talking about a couple of David Neilman. Mm-hmm. podcasts, mm-hmm. and how he sort of focused on different things. Like, you know, you could spend a few bucks on food, or you could spend $5 on a screen, and what's going to get the better value for the customer.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I haven't heard I've only heard the snippets from them. I want to, hunt that podcast down. I think there's one that's, we'll see if we can dig it up out of their show notes. But there's, I think two or three good podcasts, Airlines Confidential, and then another one that has that. And it's an interesting perspective of sort of how they balance out. I would love to have been in the boardroom when the American leadership actually ripped out screens, which they're, you know, out of their beautiful A319s and some of the newer aircraft that were coming in. Because the U.S. Airways, or legacy U.S. Airways leadership, just didn't believe in screens.
I'm pretty sure Doug Parker had something to do with that. I'm sure he was speaking up
in those
boardrooms.
There's no doubt. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, I guess hindsight, you know, that was probably the wrong thing to do. I mean, I think, you know, you may not even use a screen, but you know, having it there, it does, I think, improve kind of the environment for passengers. And occasionally it's good to have, you know, it's just nice not to hold your phone. You can actually just, like, you know, sit back and watch something, you know, instead of having to hold your device or have it perched kind of precariously on some clip or something.
The one thing I'll say is mm-hmm. having flown JetBlue a time or two, those screens do look pretty, pretty old. So if you're not going to be committed to the screen with the occasional upgrade.
Yes.
It's going to make it just seem very, very evident that your aircraft is a very old aircraft.
It will date your aircraft if you've got kind
very
of the
so.
The very old, you know, like LCD screens that haven't been updated in 15 or 20 years. But, you know, I will say, you know, I think one of the things that I really wish people would look at is kind of the cost benefit of catering, because I think having some elevated items like an ice cream sundae, which I don't think actually costs them a ridiculous amount to cater, you know, like how much does whipped cream and cherries and, you know, a couple of, you know, cups of vanilla ice cream, like what does that really cost them, you know, in the grand scheme of things? I mean, it's not Beluga caviar, you know, it's not Laurent Perrier, you know, it's, you know, commodity vanilla ice cream in a nice cup.
But you're talking about the same airline that saved $40,000 in 1987 by eliminating a single olive.
Well,
the airlines have a history of figuring out how to.
I agree, but you know, hey, at least they had olives and salads. You know, I mean, like that speaks to something. And there were clearly some standards, you know, that's still around these days. I mean, they still serve, I guess, in general, warm nuts and things like that occasionally on some of these first class seats or first class service, you know, warm towels, you know, those type of things still persevere, right? Even 20, 30 years after they became kind of a standard of service, right? Even though many other things have changed.
Yeah, I still come back to that there's a level of romance with some of the food products that we have on board. Like, I mean, you know, yeah, economy, those aluminum foiled meals, no, that's not. But in between the cookie, between the sundae, between the warm nuts, I mean, there are things that, like, if I think back, right, and mm-hmm. and you know, I didn't fly in premium cabins, but once when I was a young kid, we'll go on a tangent real quick. I was, I don't know, 5 or 8 years old, and I was flying down to see my grandparents with my mother, and we go to the check-in counter sometime in the mid late 80s, and the check-in or the agent at the counter asks, okay, what seat do you want? And I pipe up and I say, well, I really like the window seat, but my mom likes the aisle seat. And the agent pecks at her computer and hands us, okay, here you go. And my mother looks and she's like, kid, you just got us upgraded to first class. So that was my first experience. I think that was my first experience in first class, but I didn't normally have that. And so when I started working, traveling for work, and I'd get those random upgrades, and you get the warm nuts and you have the pre-departure beverage, and like the warm nuts, the cookie, those were things that made me feel like nostalgic, I guess, mm-hmm. for kind of the experience of the road warrior, right? I mean, you talk to a lot of people and the road warrior culture is not great, right? I mean, you spend a lot of time away from your family. There's a lot of sacrifices. I mean, it's not all up in the air with Ryan Bingham. But, you know, that warm cookie is that comfort. It's almost like that nice warm blanket that actually is a warm blanket, you know, for your tummy. And so it's a little bit of a shame that those things don't really exist as regularly as they had.
Yeah, I mean, I think they a lot of things have gone. You know, a lot of these things are, you know, in the history books, and you know, we're having conversations like this where we kind of, you know,
reminisce
and talk fondly of what existed in the past. But you know, at the same time, you have, you know, airlines that are very much you know, trying to sell you an experience, you know, and so in some ways, you know, you feel that other things are coming in, you know, to kind of replace some of it. You know, I remember, you know, as a child, you know, they would have playing cards, right? And they'd have plastic wings and those type of things.
They and still have the plastic wings for kids, by the way.
I know that they do.
Oh,
but at the same time, you know, what they didn't have, which they have now, is now it seems like all the big three are handing out trading cards for the different airlines, you know, different aircraft in the fleets, right? That the pilots are able to hand out. So there's other collectibles that are kind of finding their way kind of into the standards.
So Delta was big on that. If I recall, it was either, I think it was it the Union that paid for it with United or American? Whoever just recently got them?
I think American. I think American is the one that just got it, and you're right. I think the Union had something to do with it.
That says a lot about an airline.
If
the Union is the one that has enough pride to be able to put money behind that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a source of pride for a lot of these pilots, too. We had a pilot on our flight to Brisbane, and he actually had, I think he had coins minted, and he gave my daughter a coin. He actually came out of the cockpit as we're flying over the Pacific and actually gave that to her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he specifically made a point. He's like, you know, tell American about this. I'm trying to build a groundswell that we need to be doing this because it's the right thing to do. And I mean, you know, a challenge coin from an airline pilot, maybe not going to get you many drinks, but I mean, the way that my daughter looked at it was pretty dang cool. I mean, she's like, wow, this is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the trading cards, we had we flew out of Lima on a Delta A350, and the pilot was so apologetic. I still get a kick out of this. A few years ago now, we're flying on this old former LATAM A350. I mean, this aircraft, there was duct tape on the seats. It was so tired, and the pilot's like, "Yeah, we don't have Wi-Fi, so you know, download anything you can now." we're sorry for the inconvenience. This is, you know, not our finest bird, but it's perfectly safe. And he came out, signed my daughter's logbook and gave her, you know, one of these nice little Delta A350 cards with all the stats and everything. And he had a source of pride.
Yeah.
And that, when you have interactions with airline employees that have that pride, I mean, that's a really special thing.
It's a cultural thing. And yeah. I think this is part of, I would say this is one of the differentiators for Delta. I mean, you know, I think Delta treats their people very well. They've got incredible profit sharing program. And the people generally, I think, are the employees are generally very engaged. And I will say the culture for pilots, especially in the Delta side, I very frequently remember sitting in the premium cabin and seeing Delta pilots come out, introduce themselves, and actually interact with the passengers. I rarely see that in any other airline, really, other than Delta. Delta seems to be the one that has made that kind of a standard. They take, you know, 5, 10, you know, 15 minutes, you know, while they're taking off, and they come out of their cockpit and they circulate themselves through the cabin and, you know, talk about the weather and talk about how, what kind of ride we're going to have and if we're on time or not. And it doesn't take a lot, but I think it is very memorable because you recognize it because it is vastly different than a lot of other airlines.
Yeah, and I feel like United used to do that before the merger. I remember a flight out. I went out. This was in college back when my wife and I were dating, and she was living in Hawaii. And I went out over Christmas break for New Year's, and I'm flying home after New Year's, and we had an issue, and the pilot. So they had boarded like, you know, half the plane, maybe a little less than half the plane. We're sitting on the tarmac in Kona, and the pilot comes out of the cockpit and says, "Hey, so you know, this is what's going on. These are the things that we're going to try and we're going to see what works. And if not, we're going to have to wait for a plane to ferry a part over from Honolulu for us." And he talks with the first class cabin, and then he kind of gives the spiel to us in the premium economy cabin. And then he gets back into the economy cabin because there were still a few people that had boarded there. And as he's talking to the guys in the economy cabin, he's like, "You know what? Hold on a second." Hustles right up to the flight deck and gets on the radio and says, Hey folks, we're going to try turning the APU on, off, and then on again. And then I'm going to talk to and then we're going to see what goes. And so he does that, turns the APU off, is able to turn it back on, even though there was some sort of indicator that indicated that was the problem that they were trying to fix. And then did it two more times when a mechanic was with him. And he gets on the intercom and he says, "Okay, folks, we have clearance to go. We're taking on extra fuel. We're going to get the rest of the passengers, and we are going to make the quickest flight to LAX that you've ever had." I mean, it was just like the old age of transparency, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a guy. He didn't have to be out here. He could have just been sitting in the cockpit. He could have been, you know, sitting in the cockpit. I mean, we didn't have phones back then, right? You know, 2003. You're maybe sitting on his, you know, iPod. But instead, he's out there talking to people, and because he was talking to people and answering our questions, he got an idea, and right. And that could have been the difference between, you know, canceling the flight or just getting there a few hours late.
You know, as I sit here, you know, one of the things that does make me think about things is, you know, again, maybe with rose-colored glasses, because, you know, you're thinking about the past, and you've always got a little bit of nostalgia. But it does make me wonder a little bit about the next generation, you know, because, you know, for us, I think we still grew up where flying was a privilege, where it was a lot of fun. You looked forward to it.
And experience.
It was an experience, and it wasn't always a full plane, you know. And I think you have things like operational upgrades, and occasionally, you know, ground staff, you know, doing a surprise and delight to a passenger, moving them up front. It does make me think a little bit, because I feel like those opportunities are just a lot more fewer and far between these days, I would think, compared to maybe when we were a little younger. Or even when we were growing up and we're starting to be kind of younger adults and we're trying to think, okay, what kind of fun stuff am I going to do? And you kind of fall into aviation and you're like, hey, it's kind of fun flying around the country, even if you're not doing anything, you know, other than, because, you know, it's fun. And I remember early in my career, You know, I love mileage runs. It was a great way to decompress. It was a great way to, you know, just see, you know, you get to see places, but it was just nice just being up in the air, being disconnected, watching some movies, being served food and drinks and taking a nap or something in a comfortable chair. And that was a pretty reasonable way to spend time and money, at least for me. And it's probably not as much fun these days. And definitely you weren't earning miles or you weren't earning anything that kind of rebated that time and expense that made, you know, mileage running kind of even more fun because it was kind of a game because, you know, it was about, hey, I want to fly really far away. I'm going to waste a little bit of time and waste a little bit of money, but I'm going to get some of it back and I'm going to get some additional, you know, elite benefits down the road. Which might be more upgrades and more of this, you know, and it became kind of a vicious or virtuous cycle, depending on your point of view. And I feel like that's not something that's as obtainable for people now, right? Just because of the nature of planes being full and them really starting to monetize the front cabin, you know, where, you know, they don't have a lot of seats to give away anymore.
It's true. It's true. I mean, you know, we used to do mileage runs. You and I used to do mileage runs together.
Together.
Yeah, together. And I mean, my wife.
Some of them actually complete, and sometimes, you know, they ended in disaster, but okay.
Well, but even the ones that ended in disaster, we tested out different things in the contract of carriage, right?
Like, that's
we
right.
learned things.
Yes, yes, that, yes.
Like, we always learned from those things, like you know, whether it was, you know, trying to visit a new lounge on a layover,
yeah.
or you know, trying to see, okay, we've got a weather delay, what can we do, can we go directly home and skip this other stop but still get original mileage credit. I mean, we were always just doing, we were just trying things. I mean,
we were trying to find the angles. Yes, it was, yeah. it was part of the game, and the game has changed.
Well, it has. I mean, it used to be, what, $200? You could fly from D.C. to
the West
Coast, D.C. to Orlando to the West Coast and then back. And, you know, kind of, you know, hopscotch around the country.
5,000 or 6,000 redeemable miles, you know, maybe just actually probably 5,000 or 6,000 elite qualifying miles and probably 10,000 redeemable miles, if depending on your elite bonus.
And then that game turned when they started to make a dollar value need, right? Like the dollar value or whatever the heck they called it loyalty points.
Revenue based.
Yeah, revenue based. And then we moved, right? So I remember doing a mileage run on American, going from 1K to American Xplat. And we did a mileage run for 74 hours in India because I needed exactly that many miles to be able to get that exact plat status. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we shifted to, my wife and I would do these date weekends where we'd fly to like Qatar, we'd fly Qatar Airways. We'd do a repositioning flight on miles. And then we'd just stitch a number of Qatar Airways flights out of Cairo or Colombo, Sri Lanka. And Colombo, Sri Lanka, by the way, I'm starting to see some good airfares, $1,500, by the way, Colombo to Atlanta. I'm thinking maybe it's still alive or maybe it died. I'm here on the premium fare deals, forum and another one of our favorite sites, figuring that maybe we can end the episode with just an interesting deal or two that we're seeing at this moment. Realizing that we have seen, because, you know, we've been talking offline, probably what in the last 3 weeks, we've seen probably 5 or 7 really good deals that we really were feeling compelled, and they just don't last very long. And I'm not even talking like a mistake fare, like, what was that YVR, Vancouver to, was it Vancouver to Istanbul?
Europe, you know, no, well, it was on Turkish, but it was, I think, to a number of YVR to various European cities for relatively cheap, like, you know, under $500 or something, I think.
Yeah, it was, I would call, you know,
a stupidly
good deal.
Yeah. That's a mistake fare. But you know, with all that's going on in the world, I mean, I think there is some discounting going on, and I would say Etihad, in particular, seems to be one of the carriers that is doing the most of this. They clearly are not feeling the normal amount of load, you know, on their flights. So they have quite a few discounted flights, although most of them are not in the U.S. They're not U.S. originating. There's a lot of European to, let's say, Asia type of flights that have been very, very advantageous, like in the $1,000 each way in business. And usually these, unfortunately, are business light fares, so they don't include seat selection or lounge access. But I think I know I upgraded one of my, I actually bought one of these. I bought Maldives to London for just around $1,100. And that was slightly upgraded from the business light fare because I did want to get lounge access and be able to make ticket changes. So I actually did buy one of these tickets and I will fly it in a couple of weeks.
I'm excited to see how that goes. I really am. And it's not just Etihad. Qatar has some interesting looking ones as well. A little bit more expensive, but you know, interesting nonetheless, I would say.
Yeah, they do, but they're just not as many. I just feel like Etihad has just dotted the map.
Much more widespread.
A lot of city pairs that are pretty advantageous. And if you just do a little Google Explore and have some, you know, put some, you know, put a couple of different big airports in Southeast Asia, you can see where you can pretty much get to all parts of Europe for just around $1,000.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Pretty good for business class.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know. It really comes down to your risk threshold. I feel like I'm ready to be willing to do something like that. I think it's just a time thing for me. And probably a time thing for you, right? Just the way that, you know, because you get into that summer season and it's like you've got family trips, you've got all these other things going on. And so for me, I'm probably not going to take my family through the Middle East, but I'm like totally game for a guy's trip.
But you know, I happen to be going to the Maldives, and it is hard not to transit the Middle
That's
East
true.
These days. Mind you, there are some options, you know, whether they be on Singapore or on Cathay, so you could, you know, route through Asia or something. But realistically, the majority of flights, if you're going from North America to the Maldives, you're probably going through the Mideast, and it will be a little bit interesting how hopefully nothing impacts me. I'm have my fingers crossed. And by the way, I'm also transiting not only through the Mideast, I'm also transiting through Europe. So I've got multiple. I can be affected by fuel shortages in Europe. I can be, you know, affected by missiles and drones in Doha or Abu Dhabi. So I have multiple ways that my vacation could be. You're reminding me. I need to double check my travel insurance. I think is what you've just reminded me.
Yes, don't forget the smog in the Maldives. Right? You've got the air quality in the Maldives.
Although you're gonna be
able to go into the new terminal.
Yes.
Oh, you're gonna get to see the new. Oh, you're gonna have to take videos. I'm so jealous. That terminal. They drove us by there a couple of years ago when we were there. My first time at the in the Maldives, first and only, and that new terminal looks gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Like the concierge or the handler that we had is telling us, yeah, there's going to be new lounges and they're actually going to have jetways instead of, you know, the air stairs.
Buses.
And, yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong, there's a little bit of nostalgia for, you know, getting out in the open air on air stairs, you know, when you're going to a tropical environment. But I'll take the jetway every time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just weird. But as a team carry on, I'll take the jetway. If I'm checking everything, yeah, I'll walk down the stairs and I'll feel, you know, all like, you know, prime ministerial or something or presidential.
Yeah, I guess even more reason to buy up a little bit from some of these business light fares, try to get some lounge access, especially in places like this new terminal in the Maldives. I still need to actually figure out where I'm staying in the Maldives. I mean, we have the resort that we're going to, but we bookended the trip by having a day in Malé before and after. And my friends want to stay in the city of Malé. I have done that before. I am more leaning toward maybe being in a different place. Despite my trying to convince them, they did not seem interested in changing their accommodation. So it is very possible I'm going to be housing myself elsewhere. You know, maybe above on one of the islands that's like north of the airport instead
of like
the
Le Meridien or
no,
Le Meridien or the Sheridan?
The I think both of them might be like speed. I forget which one
there
is.
One's
the Sheraton. The Sheraton is definitely speedboat, but I'm probably going to actually just stay on stay in a place that I can drive from the airport without having to get on a ship or a boat or some other kind of transport. Although there has been more development on some of the island that is not the traditional city or the traditional island where Male is located. And Male, for those listeners who have not been there are not aware, one of the most densely populated islands on the planet. There is literally every inch and square foot of that island has been developed and has either a building or something there. There's not any undeveloped land on that island whatsoever. And so they have started reclaiming land. In fact, I think part of the airport is probably on reclaimed land. And there's a reclaimed island, I think, north of the airport as well. And that's what I'm talking about. There's a lot of new development on kind of some reclaimed land, I think, that is north of the airport.
Well, I can't wait to hear that trip report. I really can't, because that's an aspect that we don't normally do. We don't normally cover that, you know, on a place like on Male at the island.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that'll be really interesting for our listeners. Now, absolutely. You know, and the interesting thing about that is, you know, I think it'll be informative, because so often you get late flights in and you can't take a seaplane. And so it'd be good to be able to have, you know, an idea. Hey, maybe I do want to, still take that later flight in, and I'll stay on the island. I'll be able to maybe take a little bit of a tour in the morning before I get on my seaplane to the, to the Waldorf Astoria or the Park Hyatt. I mean, there is stuff to see there. It's not just, you know, this country full of island paradises.
And, you know, I have done that before as well. You know, I've actually taken a local ferry to one of the islands that you can take public transport to and stayed there as well. So I think there are a lot of different options. I know one of them also is to pick a resort for a day or two that is, you know, that doesn't require a seaplane to go to, you know, like the Sheraton. So there's lots of options, and I think it makes a lot of sense to kind of buffer your trip so that you're making the most out of the very expensive, transfers and resort time, you know, which, you know, you're paying a lot of money for that. So ideally you want to, you know, get out of Male in an early seaplane flight and then leave the resort on a late flight. So you're maximizing your time on whatever resort island you happen to be on. And the best way to do that is buffer your trip by having, you know, a night at a lesser hotel or lesser accommodation on the island the day before and the day after you stay at the Park Hyatt or the Waldorf or the Conrad or whatever.
Exactly. And I will put a plug. So I know that Cathay Pacific does have that flight. That's a little bit harder to do, in my opinion, mm-hmm. nowadays, just the way that the tone of Hong Kong has become. I know more and more people are talking about taking burner phones there, just because of some of the laws and everything. Not offering a, you know, an opinion, but, well, you know, we talked about it with Ed.
And right? More pragmatically, you know, Cathay has not been as generous with releasing seats.
It's true. This is true.
So compared to, you know, the heyday, you know, when I would fly Cathay all the time just because it was like clockwork. You'd have space available.
What I will say, though, is that that JFK flight, if you can find the JFK to Singapore flight nonstop, you get in early in the morning. I think mm-hmm. that banks to like an 8 a.m. or earlier flight out of Singapore into Male. And that is a really, really nice timed flight. You probably get in, you make it to your hotel, your resort hotel at a point where the room is ready. I mean, it's just... That to me seems like about as optimal a flight as can be if you're okay with the 18 hours to get to Singapore. Obviously, it's a little bit less time to go to the Middle East from the East Coast, but I always just get a little bit miffed about the timing of some of the connections in the Middle East, because you either have to be earlier in the day or later in the day, right? Because there's not as many. Maybe I haven't looked at the schedules as recently, but I felt like in the heat of the day, they have a lot fewer flights, and it's just not as ideal.
Well, I can give you the data point of how I'm getting there now, which is on Qatar Airways. I'm actually flying from Barcelona to Doha. It gets in at midnight into Doha, And then the flight to the Maldives is 2 a.m. in the morning. And then I think it gets there fairly early, like 8 or 9 in the morning, which is pretty nice from getting into the Maldives. But, of course, the connection time being between midnight and 2 a.m., you know, that's kind of, you know, dead of night kind of connection.
Yeah, I feel like I'd want a little bit longer. You know, just me, I'd want enough time to be able to get a proper meal, get a shower, especially because you're going to the Maldives and you're going to pay. So you really want to get the time to provision, you know, fill that belly, fill that backpack. And then, you know, you land at like an 8 or 9 a.m. I think that's a really good time to land. You probably still make it to the hotel around lunchtime. And you've got the time to have yet another breakfast in the lounge. You're not rushed. It's just a nice experience, and I assume they still have that seaport, that beautiful seaport. It's what, like a 4 or 5 story building of every hotel has their own lounge. It's sort of funny because like everybody's in the lounge, and then they walk you down into the, you know, the gate area, and there's like this subset of people that like you're like, where are they going? Because like theoretically everybody should be on the same, you know, everybody should have been in the lounge because you're going to a resort, but. I guess there's like the one or two, you know, that hotels that just don't want to do that.
It is a little different for the Park Hyatt because Park Hyatt actually uses Transmaldivian, not the seaplanes, but they actually use actual regional jets.
Oh, really?
Because the Transit Island, at least unless something's changed, and, you know, of course, I haven't been there in a couple of years. You know, the Park Hyatt is one where you end up going to getting off at one island and then taking a speedboat from that island to the Park Hyatt. So the plane doesn't actually land on the same island that the resort is at.
Oh yeah, I do remember that. And you have like a little golf cart from the, mm-hmm. from the regional jet to your seaplane or boat?
You have a little golf cart to both, generally. Although, yes, you usually have a golf cart from the airport where you're being dropped off to the seaplane. And then sometimes they usually, you know, depending on where you're staying on the resort in the Park Hyatt, they will have a golf cart to take you from where you disembark the speedboat to either your villa, either if it's kind of further away, one of the overwater villas, then yeah, definitely it's usually a golf cart will take you because it's quite the distance to walk. But going back to your point about, you know, having a little bit extra time in Doha, I can tell you that was not the flight that I originally booked. So, yes, I agree with you. It's sometimes beggars cannot be choosers. My original flight has been canceled, by the way. So,
you were just looking. Is this breaking news?
No. This was several weeks ago. I got an email message saying my flight has been canceled, and I of course immediately started getting on the American Airlines app because this is a book with American Airlines miles, as one does, which is pretty good sweet spot, by the way. Europe to the Maldives, only 42,000, I think 500, in for business class, and it's a fairly long flight. But in any case, I started chatting on the American Airlines app, and the agent was completely useless. They didn't know what they were doing. They offered me to rebook me in coach, and I'm like, no, I don't think that's. I'm gonna get back to you. And a little bit. This happened while I was actually having dinner in a restaurant, and so I promptly, you know, hung up on whoever was chatting with. And when I did get home, I got on my computer and I looked at availability, and I saw that, you know, there was this Barcelona, Doha, Maldives, the one that I'm on now, that was available. I re-chatted an American Airlines agent and said, hey, I want this. And of course, it still took me about an hour, even though I fed them the flights and said it's available. I probably would have just been better off just canceling and just rebooking or booking it right away and just telling them to cancel the old ticket because you know, there was availability. So I could have just used, you know, and I had fortunately enough mileage that I could just have booked it straight out. That probably would have saved me some time, but I ended up just chatting with them when they say, hold, please. We appreciate your business. And
they tell you that 200 times on the recording.
Yes. It's like, I'm still working on it. Give me a little bit more time, please. And I'm like, okay. But they did eventually get me booked. And actually, it's one less stop because my original itinerary was Barcelona, Doha, Colombo.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to do that. No.
I did that on purpose because I was going to meet up with my friends in Sri Lanka.
Oh, sorry.
Because everybody got on the same flight. But unfortunately, because of them canceling,
you miss out on the chair massage too.
Yeah,
they used to have well, nice massages. Like when we did our date night or date weekend, my wife and I.
What, to Colombo?
The Sri Lankan lounge had this little corner in the lounge. It's like this really dark lounge, and you know, it's like 2 a.m. in the morning, and they're offering massages. I'm like, okay, hey,
I don't really like massages.
Who am I to say no?
I'm not a big massage person, so you know, I don't usually seek those out, but. I have seen the inside of Colombo Airport a little bit too often. You know, there have been some mileage runs and inexpensive business class that originates out of there. So, Colombo's one of those places. You know, there's a lot of them. You know, Jakarta, Denpasar, Phuket, Bangkok. You know, there's just a lot of usual suspects out there.
We need to start investigating some of those because we are overdue.
Tunis, and it's Kathmandu, Marrakesh, you know, there's a lot of them out there.
Yes. Yes. We are overdue. We need to get after that. If only for the pod, right?
Well, you're overdue. I'm flying one in like 3 or 4 weeks, so you're overdue.
No, I mean a guy I mean we're overdue for
oh,
for
a guy's trip. Yeah. Well, you know, it's only April. I mean, we still have some time. I mean, you know, our first guy trip last year, what was that? What didn't happen until, what, July or something?
June.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
But, you know, you're right.
But remember, we did the family trip. We did the family trip in March.
Okay, fine.
Fair enough. So we're behind here. But, you know, it's interesting you mentioned about that Doha thing. So I booked a flight for a mutual friend of ours. Turkish, right? Great award, going to Sicily, and it's like an LAX Istanbul Sicily, and they canceled it within like the first couple of days of the war or of this Operation Epic Fury, and I'm like, okay, you haven't given the miles back, I've tried to call, like we're so confused about what this is. Like they said, like the flight from LA to Istanbul was canceled, and we're like, but it's not. And then I every like couple of weeks I get like an email saying, hey, there's been a schedule change. And I'm like, so is it canceled? Is it just changed? I haven't dedicated the time I need to, but like, it's just very, very confusing.
There's certain carriers in this world that are just not a pleasure to deal with.
And this is true.
And I'm guessing some have the letters TK, unfortunately. By the way, hopefully that has nothing to do with me, you know, but anyway, it just happens to be an airline whose initials are TK, that might be one of those. I would say there's probably another one. Is Avianca A? What is Avianca?
I think it's AV.
Is it AV? Okay. Yeah. Avianca is probably another one of those. There's probably a couple of these airlines that are like that.
Although Nick seemed to imply that they're getting better, yeah. which gives me hope.
I had to cancel a flight on them, and I was so happy that I had a coworker who was bilingual, and I handed the phone over to her, and she just went to town and said, Senor Kim needs to, you know, do the following, blah, 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 blah. And it was amazing, and I wish I still worked with her. And it's probably good that I don't have any Avianca flights booked anyway.
I'm trying to think of current coworkers that I could leverage. Let's see. I think I could safely book with Vietnam Airways now.
Okay, there you go. And that is another country that you have managed to somehow avoid despite our best efforts on multiple occasions.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. Okay.
The goal is we are taking a 3-week winter Christmas trip. The goal right now is, and I'm putting it out there, you know, listeners, if you see things that make sense, feel free to share. You know, would love to get any tips and tricks. But we're looking at trying to fly out before Christmas to Japan, go to Tokyo Sea. Dia, friend of the pod, has said that age four or five is the time to do Disney. And that's where my daughter is. And so we're going to try to do Tokyo Sea. For Christmas, see it all done up in Christmas decorations. And then we're going to fly down to Vietnam. I want to go to the Park Hyatt. What is it? The Park Hyatt Saigon?
Mm-hmm.
Or Park Hyatt Hanoi? Or are there both?
I don't think there is a Park Hyatt in Hanoi. I think it is.
Yeah.
It is
Park Hyatt Saigon.
Yep.
We're thinking that we're either going to stay in Hoi An, Da Nang, or where is that other one? Poof Rock? That remember the Marriott that had the different
Fuquak.
Rooms?
Fuquak.
Yeah, Fuquak. The cool Marriott with like different rooms that were like, you know, like it was essentially a university. You had the bar was the chemistry lab and stuff like that.
We could go into a whole other conversation about this because, you know, that is there's a Starkitect that is responsible for that JW Marriott.
You're
and
right.
he's also responsible for the Intercontinental Hotel in Da Nang. Right?
Yes.
He's also the architect there. And did you see
in Da Nang, you have to take like a little tram up to the breakfast place, and they've got like, it's, I mean, there's just so much coolness that I'm just I'm geeking out on.
My first trip to Da Nang was all about visiting that hotel. Of course, I happened to pick Tet Holiday to visit Da Nang, and that hotel was sold out. So of course, the whole reason I wanted to go completely was eliminated because I had saw that hotel and I was intrigued because it was at one point the number one hotel in like Travel and Leisure magazines, you know, hotels of the world. And I was like, the Intercontinental Da Nang is the number one hotel.
And I never would have thought.
It blew my mind. This is, of course, 2016, you know, but this was the year where I was essentially kind of early retired and visiting the world. And that put Da Nang on my map. And of course, the date that I happened to pick, it didn't even occur to me that like there's some major holiday around there. Of course it was, you know, Tet Holiday, Chinese New Year. I mean, like, duh, you know, I mean, like, I don't know how I didn't know, but I didn't know. So.
Well, we will make you proud and make sure to stay at the Intercontinental Da Nang.
And by the way, HAN, SGN, two other good hotel or airport codes to include in your search for inexpensive business class flights or award availability, because there are often some interesting routes out of those two cities that can be very, very advantageous for a miles and points aficionado.
Absolutely. I mean, just to put a finer point on that. So what, a few years ago, 2021 or 2022, the Traegers, so Michael Traeger of Zork Travel and Zorkfest, another friend of the pod who we probably need to have on at some point again,
mm-hmm.
He and his wife flew, I think it was New York, Japan, down to Saigon, I think, or SGN. And I think they did that for like under $2,000 a round trip. In business class, and you know, I get that that's a high cost, but when you think about being able to reduce all the frustration of, you know, trying to stitch together award flights and all that other stuff, it seemed like a pretty good deal to me. It might have been like in the 1800 to 2100 range. I don't know that we'll see that again in the near term, but
doesn't appear to be. Yeah.
That was not uncommon in even before the pandemic, where you could do a Japan Airlines or a Cathay Pacific down to SGN or to Denpasar Bali or Jakarta. Jakarta is a really good one, too. That's still a good option for finding flights.
Originating, though, not originating on the U.S. side. I think the days of originating in the U.S. and then making it out to Jakarta, they did occur, and that did happen back in the day. But in recent memory, I haven't seen it. But at the same time, originating in Jakarta, originating in Denpasar, originating in Vietnam, those do seem to be good choices for finding. Inexpensive. And I think anything, you know, crossing, you know, most of the globe in business class for $1,000 each way, I think that is the new normal of winning, basically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really comes down to if you can stitch together a few trips, you can probably do things for fewer miles and fewer dollars combined, and you can have some really great experiences. But I mean, it also requires a lot of planning and a lot of flexibility. And I mean, I totally get that not everybody has that ability, but if you like, so I have, give me a second here. I've got a great, so don't usually do this. So we have, and I have the other side that has all my dates on it, so I can't show you that with the highlights, but we use this calendar, and this
old
is
fashioned.
Like, this is my map of the year. I call it. It's my map of the year. And I put I put our my wife and I get days off, second Friday off every other week, right? And so I put that day, I put our holidays on, and then I have like a running tracker of how many days off we have, each of us. And we just highlight little areas where we want to, you know, try to stitch together a trip. And so any given time, if I see an award alert or if I see a good airfare, I can just pull that out and I can start stitching together, hey, what does this look like? And then, you know, in another month or two, I'm going to have the same thing for next year. And I just like the idea of being able to really start planning and sort of sketching things out. Because if you can stitch together, you know, a one way or a round trip fare from Southeast Asia, you know, hey, I'm going to be there in, you know, January and I'm going to need to fly home. Maybe I don't want to go back in March. Maybe I want to go back the following, you know, Thanksgiving, or maybe I want to go back the following Christmas. And if I can sort of stitch those things together, I can, I can find some efficiencies there. And I'm sure our listeners and viewers, do we have viewers? I'm sure some folks are actually seeing us.
I think some of us are watching us on YouTube. Yeah, I think some are. Definitely.
Well, the viewers actually will get a little extra this episode, right? Because you're going to put in some of your photos.
Oh, I will.
They got to see our the menus. They get to see my little calendar map, and so I'd encourage our listeners to be viewers of this episode.
Yeah, fair point, and we'll try to give you a little bit more interesting things on the YouTube side that will, I guess, hopefully make it worth your time and your eyeballs to use a few more senses to enjoy our podcast. But I will say that I probably have completely lost my train of thought, but we're probably gonna have to edit that part out. But
that's great. That's great. Oh, that's fantastic.
But I've really enjoyed this walk down memory lane and kind of remembering what, you know, used to be and what were really an amazing flight for me and remembering Continental. You know, may they rest in peace, although many bits and pieces of them still stick around, including the good Copa. Old Blue Globe. Yeah, and Copa. Yeah.
Continental lives, continues to live in Copa Airlines.
Yes, that's right.
They have that same annoying business class seat on their, I think on their 737 MAX 9s.
They refuse to let Continental die. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, hey, but let's be honest, a lay flat on a narrow body, I give them all the credit in the world.
Oh, yeah.
I just wish they flew it to BWI or Dulles, which they don't.
They're working on it. They got to get some more MAXs, I guess.
Yeah. I hear Boeing is going to be able to ramp up their production of MAXs soon.
Yeah.
Finally.
Yeah.
They just need to keep all the doors intact.
Well, I look forward to talking to you next time. By the way, I've got some gripes and grievances that I can talk about. Next time we talk.
Okay. Well, we'll save that, and definitely we've got that trip report, and I think we might have another special guest for the next episode.
Yeah.
We'll we won't tease that too much, but I think that's the show. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.